You're listening to TIP.
Hey everyone, welcome to this Wednesday's release of the Bitcoin Fundamentals Podcast. This episode is brought to you by River, the place that I personally go to securely invest in Bitcoin with confidence and with zero fees. On today's show, I have Will Cole and Parker Lewis on to talk about some of the more interesting things happening from a payments processing standpoint. We start the show off talking about billionaire Bill Ackman's recent comments on Bitcoin, what he might be missing. We also discuss Michael Saylor's comments on Bitcoin being more of a property as opposed to a medium of exchange, and much, much more. This is one you will not want to miss from two of the most thoughtful people in the space. So with that, here's my interview with Will and Parker.
Celebrating 10 years, you are listening to Bitcoin Fundamentals by the Investors Podcast Network. Now for your host, Preston Pysh.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. I'm sitting here with Parker Lewis, Will Cole. Guys, I'm so thrilled to have this conversation and just dive into all things Bitcoin.
Thanks, Preston. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it was good to see you on the slopes a couple days ago. We'll turn right back around. No days off.
Did Parker tell you he saved my bacon?
Nah. I did not hear. Not so.
It was really easy, but helped get Preston and his son down the mountain.
Oh.
I mean, they were doing great, but his son just needed a little bit of a boost.
let's just say it wasn't one of my finer moments, Will. It was it was getting a little dicey, a little disastrous on my side, and Parker luckily was behind me, and I didn't know he was there, and he came up and just kind of rescued us a little bit. So yeah.
I'm like, all right, let's get those skis on. Let's go. Well, yeah. That's all it took.
You know, that's my home mountain. You know,
I
had to cancel last minute, but the FOMO was there.
It's not an easy mountain. It's a very difficult
mountain. No, it's super challenging.
Yeah.
The vert.
All right, so I'm going to start this off in a very weird spot. Have you guys seen this NFT Nick.eth guy that he's like, be rich, and just like the scammers are coming back in full force, and just it's getting weird.
And we destroyed a couple of my brain cells. I don't think so, but tell us about them.
No. Will, have you seen this on Twitter?
Oh, I have seen him. I was scrolling through at night. I thought he was like a rapper or something. And then I turned on the volume and he's just like talking about being rich. Yeah.
I'm concerned because we're not even at the halving yet. We're not even at the halving. And typically, you know, in previous cycles, this is stuff that you would see in like a year and a half from now or whatever. And like, it's already cropping up and it's already getting crazy. And I think a lot of people are seeing all this building that's taking place on top of Bitcoin. And they're thinking that maybe we're not going to see another scam rug pull cycle. And when I'm seeing this online and it's just going crazy and everybody's talking about this guy and we're not even at the halving yet, I'm just kind of concerned as to like what to expect here. So you guys are super based. Let's help the audience like just be aware. Like, what's the advice that you have for friends and family that are now going to be coming to this probably for the first time and taking it serious, because the fourth time it still isn't dead, and I think everybody's going to start waking up to what's happening here. So like, what kind of advice do you guys have?
Well, you know, first of all, I'd say Nick, in this case, the NFT guy, seems to be like overly concerned with the haters, I believe, is who he's concerned with. A lot of haters out there. I didn't even know he existed until a couple days ago.
Yeah.
Apparently he already has haters, but so don't listen to the haters. But really, first of all, I mean, like, this is why most of the high integrity people I know in the space have always said, focus on Bitcoin.
Yes.
And don't focus on the rest. It's the catch-all cure to protecting yourself from 90% of the 95% of the grifters and scammers out there. It'll keep you focused. Now, there's still some in the Bitcoin world as well. We have our own NFT scammers running about, not necessarily, you know, showing off their homes and things like that. But if you stick to Bitcoin, then you'll avoid 95% of it.
And then what I would add is, I think that so much of this is human psychology. Bitcoin's hard to understand. And on top of it being hard to understand, people late. And then if they're told a story about art or digital or and it's easier for their mind to map to it, then they can try to play catch up, essentially. They want to, you know, they're being told a story about how this is going to be better than Bitcoin and they can use these things to actually earn more Bitcoin, that it starts from a position of fear that you're late and that this is somehow a way to catch up. And in reality, it's going to be a way to impoverish yourself, and that it's not just stick to Bitcoin. It's actually study it and learn it, because it's not rocket science. It really isn't. And it's pick up a book. Will had a great comment when we used to be at Unchained, where he's talking about holding keys and saying, you know, it's not really harder than driving a car, but if you don't know how to drive a car and get behind the wheel, you could do a lot of damage to yourself. Bitcoin is not the most complex thing in the world. It's also not easy to understand. It just needs some dedicated attention and intentionality. And so don't feel late, because if you poll the world, there is no way that 1 in 100 people understands Bitcoin. And if you start to survey the people around you in your own life and you feel late, and then you accept that fact that no fewer than 1 in 100 people actually get what's happening here, you're not late. And if you study Bitcoin, you're going to find the signal. But if you skip right past that to take what some alchemist is selling you and selling you something that is too good to be true, then you're going to set yourself back, and you won't just lose money. It'll probably further impair your ability to want to jump in and understand Bitcoin.
People will hear that and they'll see the price of $72,000 per Bitcoin and say, how can you say I'm not late? Because they're looking at that sum of money and it maybe exceeds their entire life savings. And they're saying, I'm very late. Like, how much higher can it go? And I think that that's a very fundamental missing piece. They don't understand the problem, first of all. And then they don't understand how the problem is actually going to resolve itself through this appreciation of Bitcoin. And so help people understand, in your framing, like, where is $72,000 per Bitcoin in this timeline or this adoption curve from your point of view?
So I'll give my perspective, and then maybe we'll can add his. The dollar is our unit of account. Well, I'm not going to say a number of dollars that it's going to be worth in the future, but the dollar price of Bitcoin is an output of people adopting it as either property or money. And that really re-anchor on the idea that if an adoption wave of Bitcoin happens and say 10x the number of people start demanding Bitcoin as property or money, and you can't create any more of it, if there only ever be 21 million, then you have to bid the price up in order to deliver value to an existing holder of the currency to then get your X percentage of the pie, of the amount of currency. When I talk about why 72,000 is still very early, it's that they're printing trillions upon trillions of dollars, and only 1% of the population at best understands this. And literally those other 99 are the ones that are still yet to adopt it as money. And so it really is the best anchor point to understand how early it is, and is to index your own population or group of people around you. Because if you're the person that you think is probably most in the know, but you still don't get it, and then you look at your parents and your extended family and then go to work and just see what the poll test is, that it's very obvious that very few people get this. And then if you compare it in the relative side of saying Bitcoin is just worth over $1 trillion, but the Federal Reserve printed $5 trillion between 2019 and 2021. In aggregate, I believe global central banks increase their balance sheets by over 12 trillion of base money. I think the total number of broad money is 80 trillion. The total global credit system is 400 trillion. That Bitcoin is a new form of money that's replacing all other forms of money. And very few people understand it. You can experience that your own life. And 72,000 is a very small number. It's even smaller than 21 million. But 21 million of the total Bitcoin that will ever exist is incredibly infinitesimal relative to the 400 trillion global credit market. And that's the thing that's collapsing.
Just to piggyback on that, it's just giving someone a sense of scale. And I think that's the hard thing to do, right? Bitcoin at $1 trillion market cap. What does that mean for other assets, other monies, for the economy in general? It's only very recently that anyone dared utter the T word, trillion. That wasn't part of the way we talked about money in 2009, when Bitcoin was first coming out. The original TARPs were at 600, 800 billion, something like that. They were still under, no one would say the T word. So giving them a sense of scale that 1 trillion is actually on the global scheme of things fairly early. I mean, we're still talking about gold at what, 12, 13 now?
Yeah.
It's a very small part of the financial world in this moment. So small that there are many use cases that it can't serve right now. And if you think that Bitcoin is ultimately going to serve some of those use cases, like other companies other than MicroStrategy holding, exposing themselves to Bitcoin on the balance sheet, at this price point, it's not even useful to a company like Apple with hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yeah, which is mind-blowing to think.
Also, that was a good point. I mean, I was somebody who had to understand why gold was money in order to then understand why Bitcoin was money and the properties that were inherent in it that are now inherent in Bitcoin that are causing global adoption of Bitcoin. But people don't have to understand gold in order to understand Bitcoin. So as I did personally. But if you think about like this question of how early it is, someone doesn't have to understand why gold has emerged as money, but they generally know that it did. They're familiar with the gold standard. And the reality is that gold emerges money over thousands of years. And this is year 15 of Bitcoin. So the amount of time, where it is today versus where it was at inception, and then the relative few number of people that actually get what's happening, and you can test that in your own environment, and then it costs nothing to print $1 trillion. It costs nothing to print $5 trillion, and that's really the problem that we're here solving.
Recently, we had Bill Ackman, for people that aren't familiar, very famous value investor. He tweeted and is now talking about Bitcoin all of a sudden. I'm going to read this tweet. It's a little long, but I'm going to read what he said. And I'm looking for your feedback and your thoughts on the comment. He says, Bitcoin price rise leads to increased mining and greater energy use, driving up the cost of energy, causing inflation to rise and the dollar to decline, driving demand for Bitcoin and increased mining, driving demand for energy, and the cycle continues. Bitcoin goes to infinity, energy prices skyrocket, and the economy collapses. Maybe I should buy some Bitcoin. Some serious tongue-in-cheek. What are your thoughts on this comment?
I mean, Bill seems to be waking up to quite a few things recently, not just Bitcoin, but he's learning a lot about the world. This is like a coming of age moment for Bill Ackman. I know he's a lot smarter than me in a lot of ways, but it's very encouraging, and everyone goes through their own path. But no, what I would encourage him to do, and I know several people reached out to him on Twitter, but in case he listens to this, is to actually listen to the heads of the grid systems in the United States, those like TVA and ERCOT, where the presidents of those like critical infrastructure have talked about the fact that Bitcoin is helping them not just stabilize the grid, but lower energy costs. Now, his ultimate conclusion there is correct, that he should be buying Bitcoin, but not necessarily for the reasons that he stated. Namely that, you know, Bitcoin's interplay into the energy markets is actually one that to date and probably for the foreseeable future will be drastically lowering the price of electricity, which again, the biggest operators of the largest grids in the United States are already recognizing and sort of competing over getting that business.
I'd say like Bill is just lost in a very scary fiat world, and he's kind of he's very fiat minded. You know, it's hard to get out of that fiat mindset when that is your life. But that point that Will made, I'll make it slightly different. That end about like Bitcoin driving the price of electricity down, and everybody has this idea of the dollar price of electricity. Well, if you're a Bitcoin holder and the price of Bitcoin is going up, what is getting less expensive? Not only everything, but particularly electricity. The value of the currency is buying more and more electricity. So without even having to make an argument about what Bitcoin mining will do for energy, it's just this fact that if you are a holder of Bitcoin, the currency, the price of your electricity in a Bitcoin denominated world continues to go down, down, down. The other thing that he just missed about economy or the ways that quote economy works and doesn't collapse is that he's right that a rise in the price of Bitcoin will result in an increased demand to mine Bitcoin, which will increase the demand for power. The massive thing that this Wall Street genius just missed was in result of a rise in prices does come supply. So if there's this resource power and on a relative basis, there's a bid for it, then what do? They build more power. That's the way that money works. So it's, hey, you use money, you turn it into, you know, you trade it for resources, you then sell whatever you created for more money. And that what we're actively seeing happen, you know, here in the state of Texas, where there's a lot of mining, there's more demand for power. And just in the last 2 weeks, there's been an announcement of a 1.5 gigawatt facility and a 900 megawatt facility. So in Ackman's like circular thought process of like higher price of Bitcoin, more mining, he didn't think about, well, what about supply? You know, what about supply for power? And he also, I don't think, or at least he didn't intimate it, the understanding of the power problem, the duck curve, and Bitcoin, and to Will's point about the CEO of ERCOT, the president of TVA, understanding just how valuable a large flexible load is. And so it is that Bitcoin is perfectly complementary to grids. It actually solves a problem for grids. That's why on a fundamental level, it will drive down the cost of power. Second thing is, as the price of Bitcoin goes up, your power costs go down if you're a Bitcoin holder. That's a good thing for you. And then the third thing is that the actual increase in demand for power drives increase of supply. Money is the one thing that cannot have, or if you have good money like Bitcoin, does not have a supply response because it is finitely scarce, or in other forms of money, in terms of gold, it was relatively scarce, but it was also relatively harder to go get more gold out of the ground relative to producing other things that were more readily available or could be produced from more readily available resources. So supply is the key in this equation, Bill. We can turn on tens and tens of gigawatts of power, and it's going to be great for everybody.
I'd throw in one more piece of advice for Bill here, which is like, I don't know if there's a word for it, like an anti-appeal to authority, which is, you know, all those professors and administrators that you just found out know nothing about the world and in fact are infecting people's brains at Harvard, and specifically your kids. They all think Bitcoin mining's terrible, running up energy prices. And so that's a counter signal to you.
Yeah, we'll have to get him we screened a copy of Elena Medievia's Stranded documentary, which is a short of her Dirty Coin. So we'll have to see, yeah, if we can't get old Bill Ackman a pre-screening of that. I'll call in a favor for him.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
So one of the most common questions I get from family and friends is, Preston, where do you buy your Bitcoin from personally? And the answer is really simple. I buy it on river.com. Not only can you easily buy Bitcoin with zero fees on recurring orders, you can have peace of mind knowing Bitcoin on River is held one-to-one in multi-sig cold storage, all while being fully licensed and regulated in the U.S. Plus, their relationship managers are U.S.-based and available by phone for you or your business. Additionally, River has built their own infrastructure from the ground up, which means they don't rely on third parties to function like the other Bitcoin exchanges. River also created a new feature not found anywhere else called River Link. It allows you to send Bitcoin over a text message to easily orange pill your family, pay a friend for dinner, or send a gift. There's absolutely a new standard in Bitcoin, and River is setting it. So go to river.com/fundamentals and get up to $100 free when you sign up and buy Bitcoin. That's river.com/fundamentals.
The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting. From finding the best guests, to the maintenance, to organizing the cleaners after every guest day. With Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a data-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, homeowners earn on average 20% or more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa makes vacation home ownership easy. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home by doing less, partner with Vacasa at vacasa.com. That's vacasa.com to get started on your dream of owning a vacation home. Do you guys ever feel overwhelmed with all that's going on in the markets and you feel like you just can't keep up with the day-to-day news headlines? Today's show sponsor, Yahoo Finance, is my go-to solution to keeping up with today's top news and stay informed with what's happening globally. With Yahoo Finance, I'm able to see the biggest trends and biggest movers in the stock market, what's happening with interest rates, major geopolitical events, and much more. If it wasn't for Yahoo Finance, I would have no idea that Tesla is laying off 10% of their staff, or why iPhone shipments are down 9% year over year. Yahoo Finance also has a number of other cool features, including a tool that lets you link in all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts. Yahoo Finance is one of my favorite tools that I use in my investing toolkit, and it's what I read each morning to kick off my day to stay in the loop with what's happening in the markets. Join more than 90 million monthly users today and get comprehensive financial news and analysis at yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
One of the other things that I think isn't even being discussed in both of your salient points is we're incentivizing energy infrastructure the cheapest that we can build it, right? It's being built in areas that incentivize 4 cents or between 4 or 5 cents per kilowatt hour in today's prices. So like, that's the part that I just find miraculous that people can't piece it together, that you're creating this incentive structure of the most ESG friendly thing that's ever been done without public policy playing a role in trying to build more energy. It's not me saying this anymore, and another Bitcoiner saying this anymore. You literally have BlackRock putting on these large summits in the past month, and they had an entire section for Wall Street banks that they're providing this for, that they're saying Bitcoin is ESG friendly. And they're having speakers of people within the Bitcoin space that I know up there literally talking these points, Troy Cross being one of them. If you would have told me this 3 months ago, I would not have believed you for a second that you would have an entity like BlackRock basically propagating these true messages that have been so lost on everybody for so long. So, like, what do you guys take away from something like that? This is good, right? I don't really know what to say, but I'm just blown away by it.
My view is, I completely agree. One, if somebody gets one layer down of Bitcoin mining, they will begin to understand that Bitcoin miners have every incentive to go find the cheapest sources of power. And then the next layer down, you'll figure out that the cheapest source of power is closest to the fuel functionally. Now, there are other reasons strategically why it might not be closest to the fuel in terms of acting as a balancing effect to large city centers. And so that point is right. It's just that for me, the key of this, and I do think it's not curious that BlackRock, once they got into the Bitcoin ETF game, that they would change their tune on what is and isn't ESG. I think that there was like weapons of mass destruction can be ESG, depending on who owns the company. And so I think what happened first was they figured out that there was an incentive to make money issuing a Bitcoin ETF. If they didn't do it, someone else was going to do it. And the next part of that was, well, we can't keep parroting these ESG things because we've been saying that Bitcoin's bad for the environment for so long, but us as BlackRock, we want to make money. So now we're going to drop the term ESG, which Larry Fink said that they would do in June of last year. And now it's not curious that they've shifted around to now explain that it's actually good because it aligns with their profit incentive. And so I think all of that perfectly maps. It's just, in order to understand why Bitcoin goes out and seeks the lowest cost power, you got to understand something fundamentally about Bitcoin and energy. I wasn't using that as an explanation because it was just this more broad economic fact that as you bid the price up of something, people supply more of it, particularly in the context of power, then that actually drives down the resource. The more that you can deliver of it, drives economies of scale, drives costs down. And that is what is going to happen in Bitcoin mining. In Texas, to give you an understanding, I think the peak demand last year, which was a peak ever, was about 85 gigawatts. The average demand is 40 gigawatts. And that difference between 80 and 40 or 85 and 40 causes real havoc for reliability, particularly in certain parts of the year where those type of things can swing from day to night. And Bitcoin mining is going to incentivize 40 more gigawatts of power to be online. That creates economic incentives for the power companies to lower the cost broadly. But then in addition to that, we're probably going to build another 80 gigawatts in Texas to support not just Bitcoin mining, but other economic or sources of demand that generate real economic activity. And so I think it's great that BlackRock is now recognizing all of the great benefits for the world and sustainability that come with Bitcoin. I happen to believe that their number one motive is profit.
Yeah. And Preston, it's going to be hard. I mean, I do agree with the premise of your comment. However, it's going to be hard to get me too excited over, you know, the idea that Bitcoin being ESG friendly is a good thing for the world, or that notion is a good thing for the world, given that the premise of ESG is completely ridiculous on its face. However, I do get your point that, like, the gatekeepers that there are on Wall Street and in the world financial market saying Bitcoin is good for the environment is probably good for us.
Yeah, I love your point, Will, because it's like you're almost playing into their hand by even saying ESG and talking about it as being a valid objective talking point. But yeah, I just find it quite miraculous that they're like totally leaning into what are very valid and true. Like, if you sit down with somebody who deeply understands this and you go very deep on the facts around it, it's a little refreshing to see some of the legacy talking heads really start to embrace these ideas that we know are true and valid.
Sure. So, I mean, Preston, I don't know what you think, but I thought what was more remarkable about Larry Fink's comments was not the ESG side, but the fact that he came out and said, if you're worried about your government, if you're scared of your government, if you're scared of money printing in the jurisdiction that you live in, like, that's not someone who's gone halfway down the rabbit hole.
No, you're right.
That's a pretty advanced understanding of the value proposition of Bitcoin.
Just when he started, this is, I think, in the summer time frame, when he started saying the word hope in the same sentences, I was like, okay, Michael Saylor has a website that's literally hope.com and like all this stuff's laid out there. It seems like he was binge watching the Breedlove Saylor series and like whatever else, right? Anyway, speaking of Michael, so he was on CNBC today, purchased another 12,000 BTC for $821.7 million. They now have 205,000 Bitcoin.
Wow, that's more than me.
No way. 205,000 Bitcoin at a basis of $33,706, which we're more than double that now. This is crazy. This is crazy. But the part that I found really interesting, and I think that what you two are building really kind of plays into, is a little contra to maybe what Michael was saying in this interview. It was like, I don't know how long, maybe seven. No, it was like 12 minutes long, this clip. He was really delineating the difference between Bitcoin as a property and Bitcoin as a currency. He's been kind of beating this drum for years now. And one of the key talking points that he said in the video, in the clip, he says, medium of exchange is only worth $1 trillion, whereas property makes Bitcoin worth $100 trillion. And it's almost like anytime Bitcoin is brought up as a currency, he is really pushing back and saying, no, this is a savings technology that you got to treat it like property on Fifth Avenue. Hold on, I got another quote here. No one, this is a quote that he said during the interview. He said, no one is trying to buy coffee with the equity that they hold from a building on Fifth Avenue, to reinforce this idea that he thinks Bitcoin should be viewed as property. What are your thoughts on this? Is this constructive? Is this, I think this is the real question I have. Is this a G7 in a very developed economy talking point versus maybe how the rest of the world sees Bitcoin? What are your thoughts on some of this stuff between property and currency?
Well, one, I guess first, we're building a company for Bitcoin payments.
Yes.
Previously worked on Bitcoin custody and kind of understand long-term store of value premise and rationale for Bitcoin, but also where we're coming from is we're building a Bitcoin payments company because we believe that it's important to do, and take that with an inherent bias that exists. Also that I personally, I won't speak for Will, but know he shares a great degree of respect and appreciation for both Michael Saylor personally, as well as MicroStrategy as a company, and that what they're doing both for Bitcoin, but then also strategically, you know, in terms of the corporate strategy and the results that it's having for their shareholders is quite smart.
Oh yeah.
And
I'm a shareholder. Let me tell you, I'm very, very happy. I'm a very happy camper.
Go ahead. I don't own any public equities or any securities that aren't equity in businesses that I've helped run. But if I did, the only one would probably be MicroStrategy. So
yeah.
And that, I think that my personal perspective is that if it comes to owning Bitcoin through a security, that MicroStrategy would be better than owning it in ETF, because he's actually trying to generate more Bitcoin per share. That being said, we're going to have an inherent disagreement about, you know, his opinion of Bitcoin as property or money. and that, you know, he made the comment about, you know, there's no one who's trying to buy a cup of coffee with a fraction of the equity of their Fifth Avenue building. And I think the point is that it's because building isn't money. And the thing that he didn't distinguish is that money is property, but not all property is money. And he was using the analogies of real property in the case of real estate, but for the same reason that real estate can't facilitate the purchase of your cup of coffee or the purchasing of software as a service or purchasing of a building is the same reason that Bitcoin can, and the distinction between money and property. And so the same reason that real estate can't serve as money is the reason why Bitcoin is emerging as property. It can be easily transferred. It can facilitate transactions, large or small, for a cup of coffee or a building. And I also think that there really isn't a distinction between a store of value and a medium of exchange. Money does both. And even Michael Saylor is intermediating a series of exchanges and storing his value in Bitcoin. He, you know, just today converted dollars into Bitcoin, and he's going to hold those Bitcoin hopefully 100 years, but then he's going to exchange it at some future point in time. And so really what he's talking about is the difference of time horizon and the type of transactions. But the mere fact that Bitcoin can do that is why it's such a good form of money.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a mind reader, but I can try to put myself in Michael Saylor's shoes on this. And like Parker, I have a lot of respect for him. But if I'm operating a public company and I've just pulled off one of the greatest speculative attacks of all time,
ever, you know, ever,
stacking sats the way he has been, I'd want to portray myself as the least threatening way possible to my regulators and to the jurisdiction that I operate my business in. And so, again, I have no reason to believe he's not saying exactly what he thinks. But if I were in that position, I would portray that is what I think about Bitcoin, because it makes me less threatening, does not challenge the ultimate status quo, which is, you know, the US dollar. And there's no reason to rock that boat if I'm Michael Saylor. I'm perfectly happy portraying Bitcoin as a skyscraper on Fifth Avenue. And that's okay, but we don't have to view it that way. And I don't think most people that have Bitcoin or, you know, have knowledge about Bitcoin think of Bitcoin outside of its, you know, monetary use cases.
I totally agree with your point there. And I've always kind of felt like that might be the reason why he kind of goes about it and talking about it in those terms. But I think for people that deeply understand Bitcoin, especially when you look at it from outside of a G7 country, like if I'm out of the United States and I take myself to some other developing nation state and I'm dealing with a local currency that's getting debased by 70 or 100% a year, and I can't get access to a bank account and all of those types of things, I'm looking at Bitcoin, I can see layer two, I can immediately settle and I can conduct payments. And I'm saying, how in the world is this not the currency, Bitcoin as a currency? It can be property and currency. Parker's very thoughtful point. How in the world am I not saying, and if somebody comes to my store, let's say I'm a store and I'm a vendor, like I'm looking at them like, you can pay in Bitcoin and take that Coke or that coffee or whatever it is, or else you can just leave. And I'm not going to give you this proof of work thing that is sitting in my store, because I'm not accepting the worthless currency that's debasing at 100% a year. Like, I'm sorry. That's just, I think that's where the world is moving very quickly, especially in developing nations. And hey, maybe 10 years from now, 15, 20 years from now, it's a way bigger payment role in developing nation states. But I guess I can't understand how somebody couldn't see it that way right now.
Yeah. I honestly thought at the beginning of that interview that he was going to sort of change his tune, because he's been saying mostly this for at least a year, if not a year and a half now, around this like Bitcoin is property type thing. But when he was comparing Bitcoin to gold and talking about Bitcoin overtaking, eating up gold's market cap, he was mentioning, you know, what if you had gold that you could send to Japan in a matter of minutes? You know,
teleport
to Japan in a matter of minutes from the United States. Which again was, I was like, oh wow, he's going to go on that angle, which is basically talking about, you know, its monetary qualities as a medium of exchange, at least partly so. I think that there's a little bit of the use cases that will help Bitcoin overtake gold are also why it's a better money to any other commodity or property. But yeah, I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah. And I think I really personally don't distinguish between, and I understand the places are different. You know, he uses the example, even to your question, there's a lot of the world that doesn't even have access to the dollar as you know, from a store of value perspective, as bad as the dollar is, but it's functioning and it buys you a lot of things. So it is far more functional than a form of money that doesn't even do that. And that could be it in Africa, or it could be literally anywhere that's either experiencing hyperinflation today in some country, or just doesn't have access to a form of money that the rest of the world will readily accept. But he made the comment, I believe something like, you know, if you're in Africa, what would you buy? Like, you know, real estate or a house or Bitcoin. But if you flip it around, it's really the same thing if you're selling goods or services. So like, what are you saying? You should, you know, if you're in the US, you should sell goods and services for dollars and then turn around and sell those dollars to then get Bitcoin to do what he's doing. Or why not take out the very costly step? You know, Bitcoin's gone up by 20% over the last week. It's like, if you're just taking out an unnecessary step, if you actually want the Bitcoin, right? If I could take dollars, which I do in my business, but I also take Bitcoin, but the dollars that I do get, I then convert to Bitcoin, the same thing that he's doing for his business. So the point is, why not just do that on a direct basis? My number one point is, at some point, your form of money is not going to, it's going to stop working. And I get that that's controversial to say, but the fact that it's controversial doesn't change the fact that it's also the reality of printing a lot of money. And that you really
is 1 trillion every 90 days printing a lot of money.
That's a lot. That's a lot of money, Will. It's actually too much. It's so much that the human brain cannot even conceive what it represents in terms of some tangible value. And so when you start to realize that it's like, we actually have the same problem that everybody else in the world has, regardless of if we're in a G7 country and we have the global reserve currency, the problem is that our values being debased and that our currency is being destroyed. And we need to solve both of those things. We have to find a better form of money that stores value, but it's part and parcel. If it's not easy to exchange, then it's not going to store value. It's going to store value because it's going to be easily exchangeable with 8 billion people who all have first probably bought Bitcoin on their balance sheets and then figure it out at a later point in time that if they want to acquire the Bitcoin most efficiently, they can, because unlike a building, it's actually possible to transfer it. In this case, in Bitcoin, it's possible to do over a communication channel. But then also, like, there's a reason why you can't go into your grocery store and buy groceries with a treasury bond or a security like MicroStrategy. You can do that with Bitcoin because of its properties, not just that it has a fixed supply, but that you can transfer it without counterparty risk. You can transfer it with counterparty risk too, but stock or bond is not capable of being transferred without a counterparty risk, because trust is core to the nature of a security, and the trustless nature of Bitcoin is core to its ability to function as both a store of value and an ability to exchange it in return for real goods and services or dollars.
Let's not miss two very obvious points as well. One is, Bitcoin is literally money. I mean, it's legal tender in at least one country.
That's a good point.
Right. And it's used to the tune of tens and hundreds of millions of dollars every single day as a medium of exchange right now, today, even in its infancy. Number two, though, is like, not everyone has the same sort of, not everyone has the balance sheet or the savings that Michael Saylor has to buy Bitcoin the way that he's doing right now. And if they want to obtain Bitcoin, one of the best ways to do it is just to sell a good or service or your time, receive it as payment instead of receiving dollars, taking the counterparty risk, the fees involved with exchanging, you know, being a Forex trader. You just take Bitcoin on a principled basis for your time or for your goods.
Yeah, because you can.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change.
A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
As many of you know, I love studying businesses and networking with business owners. The more I've studied businesses, the more I've realized that starting and scaling your business is easier than ever because of companies like Shopify. Did you know that Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US? Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify even helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. What I personally love about Shopify is that it's the turnkey solution to kickstart and grow your business, and they are totally committed to giving you the necessary tools to succeed as a business owner. Plus, they have an award-winning customer support team there to help you every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/WSB. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/WSB now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/WSB.
All right, back to the show.
I had mentioned earlier that in some of these developing nations that have like really bad currencies with a lot of inflation, that the store owner would just say, hey, you're either paying with Bitcoin or you're going to get out. But Ben Perrin, when I was over in Madeira, him and I were having a conversation, and he had just recently he has this amazing video, by the way, for people listening, if you want to see how Zaprite with Peter and Will have built.
It's all the same.
He has this amazing video that Parker and Will have built with Zaprite that you can see how to use it, how the API works for people that are trying to integrate it. But one of the things that he said to me when we were over there was, he's like, Preston, there's this really important like mental breakthrough for me when I was setting this up, that if I'm selling a good or service and the price is X, I have another price that's in fiat that is 20% higher than X for anybody that wants to pay in fiat instead of Bitcoin. And he's like, it sounds so simple and just so like it's almost like it's not anything. But he's like, I think it's a really big jump, because instead of it being a discount if you pay in Bitcoin, he's like, I think people just mentally are looking at it and say, well, of course I want to pay the lower price. I don't want to pay 20% more. And he's like, it's a really big deal. And it struck me, and I just kept thinking about it. And this is kudos to you guys for implementing this. But going back to the store owner, I don't think it's going to be this leap from you go into that store one day and they're accepting both their legacy currency and Bitcoin. I think it's going to be almost like a checkout or like a mobile phone. And it's like, here it is. You can pay in Bitcoin for this price. And if you're paying me with this really terrible currency, I'm just slapping a 40% additional fee on top of it, because I don't want that. Like, I'll take it, but I don't want it. And this is I think that's how it's going to slowly progress and take hold all around the world, is you're going to see this model that you guys so thoughtfully constructed play out. So I don't know if there's a question in there or that you guys have anything else that you want to add, but.
No, it resonates a lot. I mean, like, it was very intentional to frame it as a premium. I think that was Parker's brainchild, actually. Although who knows at this point, we just sit together all day talking. So I can't
come up with these stupid ideas.
Yeah. I think it was Parker's brainchild, but really it's about, you know, signaling preference, right? And that if you own a store, or if you're selling something online, or if you're a dentist owns their own dental practice or lawyer or something like that, you have unilateral control over how you bill your customers and charge for your products. And when you show a preference like that, like you're likely to get what you want. And if you want Bitcoin, there's probably not a better way to signal that preference than Parker always distinguishes between Bitcoin accepted here and Bitcoin preferred here. And now you're saying Bitcoin, I prefer you pay me in Bitcoin. In fact, I will give you a discount if you pay, or you'll have to pay a premium if you pay in fiat. One company I like a lot that's been doing this for a long time is Molvad VPN. Is that they've had Bitcoin as an option for years, and they've always given a discount if you paid in Bitcoin. Now it's framed differently, but the signaling of preference is the same. And I'm pretty sure they've stacked quite a few stats through that.
I do think the framing is important. I use it with my book, and I can just tell you that when I put a 10% premium on my book, if people want to pay in fiat, my view of it, and I'll talk about it in the broader context of the importance of Bitcoin payments, is that there's a cost. It's like Bitcoin is a better form of money. It's a better form of money because it allows you to store value better, but also there's not a single point of failure in terms of how you are receiving it, or there doesn't have to be. And that if you're getting paid directly from your customers, you have not only a more liquid form of currency, but you also have a more diversity of your liquidity, which is important. And that when I put a 10% premium on, price communicates information. So the price of any good is a communication of information. If you say, hey, it costs 10% more, the book costs $30, but if you want to pay me in dollars, it costs $33. I don't actually have to have a conversation with the person. I can communicate information about the cost of the thing. And it doesn't make sense to me to say, if you want to give me the better form of money, you can actually pay less. It's that if you want to give me the worst form of money, you're going to have to pay me more because there's a cost associated with it. And then in both the way that it's a debt-based currency that has a ton of counterparty risk that introduces all this cost, that someone's got to pay for it. And if you want it to be me, I'm actually going to say, nope, it needs to be you. And then in addition to that, it's the volatility. So if a lot of merchant processing takes 10, 15, 20 days to send to you, there's the risk of chargebacks. If Bitcoin's appreciating on average over the last 10 years by 1% a day or whatever it is, then if I'm having to wait into perpetuity 20 days to convert my dollars to Bitcoin that I'm earning through my business, that's another cost in addition to just the processing fees. But on a broader standpoint, the way that we think about it is, Bitcoin is a new form of money. People are adopting it for the first time. It's not like buying a different car or buying a different building or buying something else that's marginally different than something else you've bought several times in your life. People have to, first, the tools to secure Bitcoin had to be built in order to allow people to adequately know that they could hold it without losing it. That's what improved the store of value property, improved methods of custody of Bitcoin. That's what we worked at Unchained. But the point is that in order for people to accept Bitcoin as payment, you have to build the tools. They've never existed before. You can plug the euro into the dollar system and the yen into the dollar system because they're functionally the same. It's a trust-based system. Bitcoin is a new form of money. And in order for businesses to be able to receive Bitcoin as payment, like there's many different types of transactions that require different products. And so we're not just building a quote Bitcoin payments company, we're building something specific for a certain type of customer based on certain types of payments. And the product has to be the right product and it has to be dead simple. And the product being the right product is being able to build features like what Ben mentioned to you of things that people actually value that actually incentivize the payer to pay in Bitcoin. But in addition to that, a big part of our philosophy of making it dead simple and reducing the burden on the business is that it does need to be, you can receive Bitcoin side by side with fiat because both exist today and businesses need actually to survive on both for some foreseeable future. So that's another thing that's core to Zapri is we make it really easy to receive Bitcoin and Lightning on chain and Lightning side by side with fiat such that the business, when they're thinking about that decision point, it's marginal. It's, do I want to give Bitcoin as an option? Because if you're going to make me go through an entirely different process, I'm not going to do it. I'll just take the Bitcoin and convert it to, or the fiat and convert it to Bitcoin. And so we think about all those things. How do we lower the bar such that the number of businesses that actually accept it as payment is 10x, 100x, 1000x? And I'm pretty sure selling software internationally is going to be a great application to get more Bitcoin pound for pound than if you took an Argentine peso and then converted it to a dollar and then converted it to Bitcoin.
I mean, I would add in there that it's not just the merchant preference that we're focused on, although we do focus on that side of the equation for the most part, but we're also making a deal with the merchant. Like, we're going to deliver your customers an easier way to pay, not just with Bitcoin, just an easier way to pay in general. And that if it's not easier to buy something online with Bitcoin than it is with dollars, I anticipate those customers are going to gravitate towards paying with dollars because it's simpler. So not only are we trying to like highlight the fact that the merchant can pay with a better form of money and recognize their preference for that, we have to treat their customers to a better experience. And honestly, we have all the tools we need. I would say we're about even right now, if not slightly better than taking fiat payments, but we're going to be way better. It's going to be so much simpler.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether you're using custodial, non-custodial methods of payment, it's going to be way simpler. Already is about as simple to pay with Bitcoin rather than fiat.
I'll just say I've used the Zaprite service whenever I ordered Parker's book. It was phenomenal. It couldn't have been any easier. It was super clean. But when I'm looking at, I guess this has been my talking point for the last year and a half, 2 years, is you don't have this natural demand signal that's really kind of incentivizing payments quite yet. And what I was saying that I think is going to really help boost that incentive, that natural incentive, is once Bitcoin makes a new all-time high. Because when you look all around the world, everybody's saying, oh, the dollar has done so much better. When Bitcoin was at 16,000 a coin after going to call it 69,000, they're looking at that and they're saying, I'm kind of forgetting about Bitcoin at that point because in dollar terms, it's way off of where it was. Now we're at a very, very interesting point in time because we just made a new all-time high. I think everybody around the world is starting to look at this thing in their own local currency or even the dollar terms. And they're saying, this is the fourth time that it supposedly died 3 or 4 times at this point, and now it's back. It's rebirthed itself again. And I think you're going to start getting vendors that are saying, you got a turnkey API that's going to allow me to accept payments. Yeah, I might only have 1 out of 100 people that come through the door willing to pay at a discount to the fiat price. But if it's really simple and really easy to do, and they are wanting to receive this superior form of money, I think things really start to change in the coming 2 years from a demand, a natural demand signal for Bitcoin payments. I'm assuming you guys agree with that, but what kind of thoughts do you guys have around the demand, the natural market demand for payments picking up?
I agree with your statement. I would say that's also a really rational way to think about it, right? Is like every 4 years we keep on hitting new all-time highs. That just builds up credibility over time. Bitcoin, every day it doesn't die, builds up a little bit more credibility over time. I agree that like these types of signals, there's moments in Bitcoin's history that lend it credibility. You know, when the Silk Road coins are seized and then they're auctioned off and not destroyed. That's a moment of credibility. When the first public company adds it to its balance sheet, that's a moment of credibility. When it survives internal strife and struggle in 2017, that's a moment of credibility. And every time you see it surpassing all-time highs in conversion to US dollars, that's a moment of credibility. So yeah, I think this one is going to get a lot of attention. I think it's one of those things that makes people think, I have to get more of this, or I'm not exposing my business to something weird or scary or something like that. And yeah, in terms of like the driver, the all-time high helps, but it's really just about people, same way individuals make the decision, I want to hold Bitcoin. Businesses are going to make those same decisions as well. And they're just run by the same people that are getting it individually. I do see that, you know, and our client base would bear this out, that it's easier for companies that are independently owned, you know, sole proprietors, to make that unilateral decision to accept Bitcoin. We're going to see a lot of lawyers, a lot of dentists, things like that, that own their own businesses. But more and more, it's going to become untenable for people sitting on the boards of bigger businesses to say, well, I do this for myself, but I don't do this for my business, right? Whether that's, you know, holding Bitcoin on a balance sheet and for treasury purposes, or having this superior payment structure, you know, set up for your customers. So yeah, you know, the all-time high helps there. So do all these other credibility lending, you know, the ETF moments. And then it's just a series of those independent decisions that are being made that ultimately leads us to a big marketplace of people accepting Bitcoin.
It's also very organic. So one of the things I think, Preston, you and I might have talked about this few days when we were together at the summit. But if Bitcoin, whatever it is today, it's over $1 trillion. I don't know what this is, like 1.2 trillion or 1.3.
Yeah, two or three.
That's a lot of purchasing power. And so if we're just thinking one Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin terms, we're building a Bitcoin payments company, and we're specifically building it because we recognize that orders of magnitude more people are going to demand Bitcoin to hold it as a property or money, however you want to define it. And that is going to result in orders of magnitude more people demanding Bitcoin payments. We're delivering a service that the people that are holding the 21 million supply are currently, it's like 19.6 million, say, okay, we need to find a way that something that the holders of the value or the holders of the currency value so that they can then pay us. And that as that number gets larger in real purchasing power, it becomes more relevant to more business owners saying like, hey, if you start to look and see that Bitcoin is some metric or the other, the sixth largest currency in the world or the 11th largest currency in the world, you want to sell to those people. Mm-hmm. You want to sell your goods and services. It's also, so that's the macro, that as Bitcoin becomes more of value by more people, it is a more significant opportunity for people selling goods and services, mm-hmm. And it's harder for them to ignore. If you think about Apple as an example, like Will makes a good point that I agree with, is like Apple, the company market cap is still bigger than Bitcoin. It's hard to store value in something that you're bigger than. Now that will flip too. Apple would be probably the last company that gets flipped by Bitcoin. But if you think about it relative to currencies, they're selling phones to people in more than just seven currencies in the world, that Bitcoin as a purchasing power aggregate entity is larger than practically any other economy that they can possibly sell to. That is a hard economic fact that is difficult to ignore, and particularly as Bitcoin gets larger. At the same time, it is an individual decision. And that's why we're really focused on, it's the merchant. It's like, there is a derivative rationale to paying a business in Bitcoin that you want to be around. And the example of that is, I want my rancher to be around. He wants to be paid in Bitcoin. I pay him in Bitcoin. But at the same time, it really is an individual decision. So while that's the macro that's driving the driving force, the individual is the one who is in most control of, particularly an individual who's a business owner, to say, what do they want in terms of a currency to be paid in? And that's really where we focus. There is also the rationale from the payer side. I think it's more derivative. The example is, I want my rancher to be around who's selling me beef and he wants to be paid in Bitcoin, so I pay him in Bitcoin. I value my doctor. She wants to be paid in Bitcoin, and I know that she's more likely to be around if she has Bitcoin. So if she wants to be paid in Bitcoin, I'll pay her in Bitcoin. The driving force is the merchant saying, I understand why Bitcoin stores value, and therefore it's rational for me to accept Bitcoin as payment because it's the most efficient way to get. And so we really view it as it is something that is dynamic between buyer and seller. The seller is the one in control. And as more sellers understand why Bitcoin is of value to the world, it just becomes the rational thing for them to do to drive the shift, to say, I'm going to give you the option to pay me in Bitcoin. I'm not going to cut off my nose to spite my face and say, I'm not going to accept fiat, even though for businesses that do that, more power to them. You know, a few businesses will be able to dictate those type of terms, but starting with an option is the most rational thing to do for a business owner that understands why it stores value. And if you just multiply the number of people that understand Bitcoin by 10 or 100, then there's more people who are also going to figure out why it's most efficient to just open it up as an option to be paid that way.
A little inside baseball for your listeners, Preston, here. If they've ever worked in software development or built a software company, a lot of times entrepreneurs, they'll avoid two-sided markets. They're very mm-hmm. difficult to build. I built one before at Stack Overflow. We had a recruiting site where you have employers and then you have employees or prospective employees, applicants. And you build that and you're like, what do we focus on? Do we focus on, you know, the employer side of it, or do we focus on, you know, the developers over here in the Stack Overflow world that are trying to get jobs? And I always go back to the original two-sided marketplace on the internet, which is online dating. Mm. And for the heterosexual marketplace out there, you know, it's very obvious. You have a two-sided market and only one side matters. If you have hot girls, then you have a dating app. And if you don't have hot girls, then you don't have a dating app. Mm. And so whenever you're building a two-sided marketplace, it's a good idea to ask yourself, who are the hot girls in this two-sided marketplace, right? It's an easy sort of heuristic to go through. And in this case, it's obviously the merchants, right? If the only way, or if the discounted way to get their services or their products is to pay in Bitcoin, then people are going to pay you in Bitcoin. Mm. They're the hot girls. And that's what we're optimizing ZapRite for.
Hmm. Yeah, I like to think about it. I use the example a lot, not the dating app one, but I'll pay the gas station in dollars so long as they're willing to take my dollars. But if they open up the opportunity and then they create an incentive for me to pay in Bitcoin, I'm going to pay in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But that's why it's a seller or merchant driven shift. The other thing though is as Bitcoin increases in purchasing power, this is just something for people that are new that's going to happen to you and you just kind of have to accept it. Is you're going to put like 1% of your money in Bitcoin and then Bitcoin's going to go up 10 times and 100 times and it's going to go from like 10% to 90% of your savings. And once you get into a position where Bitcoin represents pretty much all of your savings, like someone like myself or someone like Will or increasingly a lot of people that have held Bitcoin for a long time, you actually want those outlets. Like someone would say, well, it's not rational to spend their Bitcoin because it's, you know, going up X percent a year. But if you have 100% of your money or close to it in the better form of money that has appreciated over time, you actually want your liquidity to be more diverse than just somebody that allows you to convert it back into dollars. You're actively looking for those businesses. Mm-hmm. And that's what a lot of our merchants have found is they actually say, like, and we use this example because it's kind of random, but it seems to be happening more and more frequently. We have dentists on the platform. Dentists say, I want to accept Bitcoin as money and I'm going to make this part of my strategy. And they put a bat signal out to the people in their area that they accept Bitcoin. There's Bitcoiners everywhere. And then they start getting new customers. If you build it into the strategy, it makes sense. But there is also this reality that there's a lot of people that are having the vast majority of all their savings in Bitcoin. And those people need to spend it every day to survive and to better their lives. And so that is not as intuitive to somebody that only has 1% of their money in Bitcoin, but that's not them for a few more years.
Fascinating. I want to change just one final question before we wrap things up. And it's off topic from the payment stuff we were just talking about. It seems to me like from a policy standpoint, things are really heating up from like a global competition standpoint. I'm curious if you guys see it the same and just, I guess, any thoughts that you have on that particular talking point.
Yeah, I mean, I worry about this, you know, frequently being a United States citizen and, you know, wanting, I consider myself a patriot. I like the United States. I would like the United States to take a pro-Bitcoin stance because I think it's vital for the future.
Amen.
Of our country.
Yeah.
I think we have a huge outsized advantage compared to other countries, and that, you know, we have a strong history of federalism and the 10th Amendment, and that we have, you know, 50 sovereign states that are going to try to outcompete themselves on being a good jurisdiction for Bitcoin to operate in, whether it's for businesses or for payments or, you know, whatever it is, that they're going to be competing over that. But there are smaller countries out there that can be a little bit more nimble and have been to date, like El Salvador. However, you know, that global competition that you talk about, like, I ultimately think the United States is well poised for two reasons. One is we already have a lot of money, right? Mm-hmm. And we're talking about money and we produce a lot. And so that to the extent that the citizens of the United States and therefore the government, you know, obtains Bitcoin, we have a head start. And two is every Bitcoin maximalist should be a 10th Amendment maximalist because the states themselves, I think recently in the last couple of years, are getting more comfortable flexing their sovereign muscles and proving that they can make independent sovereign decisions, and whether it's Bitcoin or otherwise. And they're doing it, and a lot of it is to the benefit of Bitcoin.
Yeah, and then what I'd add is, I think, you know, one of the things that Saylor said that I think is right, he pointed out that there's something controversial about Bitcoin as a medium exchange, and there's something that's not controversial about Madison Avenue real estate.
Sure.
If it's controversial that Bitcoin is money and that it's going to be used to facilitate payments, it's like, that is a reality. It's not that, I don't think we're not naive in that respect, but I also think that it's even more controversial that it's a store of value. You know, I think that the heat that comes is the only way through the fire, essentially, and that governments need money too, and they're going to figure that out. Many are already. And that whether it's global competition on hash rate, or it's the world seems to be a little bit volatile beyond, you know, the price of any financial asset, just in terms of what's happening, you know, in terms of global conflict, right? But that it's actually Bitcoin, or it's a good form of money that everyone can trade that creates and aligns economic incentives. And that economic incentive is maximal to the most amount of people. And so everyone has an incentive to mine Bitcoin across the world. And even though there's some governments that will be more restrictive to it in the short term, as Bitcoin rises and as Bitcoin presents a more competitive, I think this is the direction you were talking about, providing more competitive pressure to the dollar, doesn't mean that any country in the world, regardless of who they are, is necessarily going to want to give up the power that they extract through their currency. And globally, that could be the dollar or the euro or the yen, but then also internal to the country, it's something like Russia, like they don't want to give control of the ruble to Bitcoin. And Bitcoin's like water moving downhill. It's going to find the most efficient path, but it's moving downhill. And ultimately, as people figure it out, whether it's a nation state, a corporation, an individual, state, local, community, they're all going to figure out that it's in their best interest to participate rather than not. And then once they're participating, they're part of this global trading network, and there's an incentive to cooperate rather than being adversarial. It's not necessarily going to immediately result in world peace, but it's going to be the thing that aligns economic incentives to steer the world back in that direction. And I think that that is, at the most macro level, the very positive thing. And then it does the same thing for every micro individual and every economic decision, to allow each individual, separate from that kind of the global backdrop and Bitcoin's position in its very competitive dynamic for world money, gives everybody a tool individually to just get up in the morning, produce value for other human beings around them, and store that value for the benefit of their family and for the people in their direct vicinity. And I think that the more people that are building toward that future, the least amount of pain that's going to be felt between here and there.
All right, guys, give the audience a handoff to the things you guys are working on.
Yeah, come check us out at zaprite.com. You can get a 30-day free trial, and you can find me on Twitter at Will Cole or Noster. I can't recite my MPub, but you can find me there.
Yeah, and it's Zaprite, Zaprite. If you're a business or individual that's either issuing invoices, payment links on a website, a more complicated web store, we're really focused on those specific types of payments today rather than something like a point of sale, but we can help support point of sale. But if you run a business, you're a Bitcoiner, you understand why Bitcoin stores value, and you're thinking that, hey, it might make a lot of sense to accept Bitcoin, reach out to us. We'll help deal with you directly and get you onboarded to the vanguard of Bitcoin payments. And then for me, you can find my book, Gradually Then Suddenly, if you're still trying to figure out why Bitcoin is obsoleting all other money. You can find that at thesafehouse.com/gradually, and then safe is spelled SAIF, thesafehouse.com/gradually.
So, all right. Yeah,
Preston, appreciate you having us on.
Thanks,
yeah.
Preston.
Yeah, we'll have links to all that in the show notes, and we'll catch you guys next week.
If you guys enjoyed this conversation, be sure to follow the show on whatever podcast application you use. Just search for We Study Billionaires. The Bitcoin-specific shows come out every Wednesday, and I'd love to have you as a regular listener. If you enjoyed the show, or you learned something new, or you found it valuable, if you can leave a review, we would really appreciate that. And it's something that helps others find the interview in the search algorithm. So anything you can do to help out with a review, we would just greatly appreciate. And with that, thanks for listening, and I'll catch you again next week.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to follow Bitcoin Fundamentals on your favorite podcast app and never miss out on episodes. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.